top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die, only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
At the beginning, she gave me things. Perfect balance, perfect sleep. Oh, she wants to get inside of me. I can feel her.
When you dance the dance of another, you make yourself in the image of its creator.
I feel like I'm not even here yet.
Madame Blanc's incredible.
One, two, three.
The way she transmits her work.
You have to decide, what is it you want to be for this company?
There's more in that building than what you can see, Doctor.
Dangerous people.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 249, Luca Guadagnino's 2018 Suspiria.
So this is the remake of Suspiria. It's a cover version. And frankly, to me, that is a much more apt description, because Suspiria, and I'm talking about the original Suspiria with Jessica Harper, Dario Argento, Suspiria,
Udo what have Kier,
you, Barbara Magnolfi. This is a film that, for a long time, was the holy grail for me. When I first started getting into horror, and, you know, I kept reading about these movies that were very difficult to find, and the one that I want to find, there were, I guess, the two were The Beyond by Fulci and Suspiria by Argento. In other words, what were considered to be, I guess, the best of each respective master. I finally tracked down The Beyond, my mind was blown, but when the time came, because when it came to Suspiria, all I heard was a couple of things. Number one, one of the scariest openings in cinematic history. Number two, one of the scariest soundtracks in cinematic history, enough to make you loosen your bowels all by itself. Number three, one of the most impressive visual palettes in, and I'm not even saying horror movie history, I'm just saying movie history. And I had seen some Argento films prior, but I kept looking for this holy grail Suspiria. I could not find it anywhere. They actually played it on TV, cut to shreds, cut to ribbons. I watched it and I was like, wow, this is beautiful. But the opening, the indelible opening scene with the murder was totally cut to shreds. I knew at that point I had not seen Suspiria. I still have to keep tracking it down. Finally got my hands on a import VHS. I actually imported it myself. I went into the store and asked them to import it for me. And when I saw it, my mind was blasted to the point that a few episodes ago, we talked about, you know, oh, could we make a top five favorite horror film list, etc. Well, I certainly can. And Suspiria is number two for me.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm.
And I would venture to say The Beyond is somewhere between 10 and 20.
The Beyond is in the top 10. Would you care to guess what my number one is? I think you know it.
Evil Dead?
No. It's a movie that's so near and dear to my heart that I've talked about it.
Frankenstein.
The Bride of Frankenstein.
Bride of Frankenstein, okay.
Indeed. But yeah, Suspiria, and I consider Argento to be my absolute favorite horror director. Of course, I'm talking about Argento's output in his prime. If we're looking at the diminishing returns of Argento, i.e. Dracula 3D, which was his last film, which was absolutely abysmal. Let's just discount those. Argento's prime was untouchable. So you have my favorite horror film, made by my favorite horror director, and now, as they do with so many other films, they decide to remake it. And, you know, I've put up with remakes for this or remakes for that. Some are more successful than others. But when it came to Suspiria, I was extremely, not even skeptical, angry. How dare they? How dare they even have the hubris to try and take something so wonderful and remake it? Then they started announcing the casting, and I started getting a little bit more intrigued. Not Dakota Johnson, because the only other movie I had seen her in was that, I'm trying to impress a memory, when you and I went to the cinema together to
watch sort 50 of Shades really of Grey. Awful movies, date night.
Exactly. And we went right back and brought... So I had not seen anything other than her god-awful turn in that 50 Shades of Grey series. But Tilda Swinton. When I heard Tilda Swinton, I'm like, okay, this is going to be something interesting, because Tilda Swinton is an actress that... I mean, she's one of the most exciting actresses working today. And when I found out something about this movie afterwards, it actually blew my mind. I don't know if you know what I'm going
to
say.
Yeah, but it's the same thing with me, and we'll figure out to what extent and see if we can explore to what extent that worked, or whether it was sort of a stunt.
I also heard that... do you know what I'm talking about?
I did, but I didn't notice it at first, which is a testament to her. You know?
Exactly.
And she crossed my radar in Only Lovers Left Alive, which I thought was really charming and really cool.
It is charming.
She's...
If you want to call a vampire film charming, it is charming.
Yeah.
And Jim Jarmusch is fantastic. And the way he used the desolate backdrop of Detroit.
I mean, God, and really playing off her sort of a... and I'm one to talk. It's unfortunate the expression is the pot calling the kettle black. Like, it's more like the sheet calling the wall white. Like, I am as pale as they come. Mm-hmm. And they really make use of her really amazing face. Like, her features are incredible. She, like, you can't take your eyes off her.
In many ways, she... I mean, a lot of people say, like, if anybody was to play David Bowie, she should do it. A, because she's chameleonic, like David Bowie. B, she slightly resembles him. She is androgynous in appearance. Yeah.
She could pull off the gender bending, and does.
And it's, I'm wondering if we should even talk about that, because I don't know if I want to... I guess we have to say that we're going to be... See, you and I saw this past weekend. We didn't see it together, so we have not discussed it at all. So, seeing the movie, walking out, I'm still processing in a lot of ways. I have a lot of questions. I have a lot of inquiries, let's say. And I think what this podcast is going to be is not so much a review of Suspiria, but almost like a dismantling it or deconstructing it. Because there's a lot of this film that is extremely noteworthy to talk about. And I kind of know where I sit right now in terms of star rating, but I really, really want to hear your opinion. You may be swaying me a bit. But,
I was hoping for the same from you. So we'll see is it even fair to say what wins out? I'm not even sure. Like, we do our best on this podcast to try and, I guess, take something that's some would argue it's subjective and objectify it by putting together a bunch of, it's almost like a Socratic method of point counterpoint for what we feel is right. I haven't made up my mind, and even more so than Halloween, which I think I did make up my mind, and then I just needed you to give me that slight nudge, and then I really knew. I suspected deep down my deep-seated problems with that film.
Well, I remember back in late summer, you saying, oh, there's three films coming in November or whatever, or in the fall I have to see. One was Halloween 2018, one was Bohemian Rhapsody, and the other one was Suspiria. You've seen all three.
I have yet to see Bohemian Rhapsody. In the theater, and they all came with so many different sets of expectations. And this one, for some reason, I don't know why my expectations were so much tempered compared with Halloween, which I just, maybe it was the TIFF factor and the just the hype and blow up and hyperbole surrounding that, but I didn't have any expectations, and I think this did me a service going into this.
Okay, well, I mean, there is a difference. This is a remake slash cover version. I really prefer to call it that, because it really, if I was to compare this movie to Suspiria, it it's no contest. I don't know, like, if you want to give me some sort of sports analogy right now of, like, you know, the biggest mismatch in history in boxing or whatever. Absolutely no contest, right? But, so I'm going to talk about this as its own entity. Yes, I will be making a few comparisons here and there to the original Suspiria, but with the exception of a couple surface similarities, i.e. a ballet school, a student from the States whose name is Susie Banyan, the fact that it takes place in Germany... And that's another thing I want to talk to you about the whole, like, you know, maybe heavy-handed use of political allegory in the film.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, I mean, and of course, you've got the three mothers, and this is this this ballet school is a what do you want to call coven. It? Coven, yeah. A coven for witchcraft. But
So it's interesting when you compare this iteration with the previous, because the previous was so simple. I mean, with all this monkey business about mothers, this and that, and the lacrimonium and the
mater
sacrimonium,
Suspirium, and, mater lacrimonium, and mater tenebraeum, I believe.
Yeah, and that is still at its heart is just a witch story. It's a possession story. It's almost like a ghost story. It has no. Weaving, arcing narrative. It's just a girl who's bewitched and comes into this situation and she tries to solve it Nancy Drew style in a way. She's a young naif. She goes in. Mm-hmm. What the hell is going on? I don't know. That's it. And that's not to
disparage it.
Yeah, it's simple and it creates its own world in a way that... the new one doesn't. So
yeah,
it's a timelessness. You don't know where you are. It's with the original. With the original.
Exactly. There's a timeless to it. There's no real sense of place. And that, I mean, is a compliment because it is. You revisited it just the other day, right?
So, I was going to, but I didn't want it to color, expectations of this one because... there were certain scenes that I want to bring up in the discussion, but it's a completely different animal.
What I'm trying to say is that the fact that it took place in Germany was irrelevant. It was just you want to transplant a foreign student into this environment and make it even more of a weird, otherworldly sort of environment because she's American and everyone else is speaking a different language and so on. It just gives the customs. But when I say no sense of place, I mean... You get the feeling that this horror that's taking place in the original Suspiria, it almost feels like a microcosm for the world. Do you know what I mean? Like that ballet school and its surrounding vicinity where you sometimes see, you know, for example, Ludo Kehr's character going, you don't see much outside the school.
Yeah.
And so the terror is cloistered within those walls and it builds and it builds and the music swells and the colors are beautiful. Maybe they're garish. Maybe they're blinding. It doesn't matter. It's an experience. And when the thing is over, you are just floored. And you mentioned the simplicity of the original Suspiria. Yeah, it's Argento himself has said this is a fairy tale. It's a fairy tale. And fairy tales, by their very nature, are simple but dark. I'm talking about the original versions of fairy tales, not the homogenized Disney versions, right? Hmm. The grim. So, yeah.
Yeah.
And you got to remember, too, that when Argento made the original Suspiria, he was considered to be a giallo director. Suspiria, and so he wasn't exactly sort of a supernatural director. Suspiria was almost like the Annie Hall for Argento in the sense that it sort of bridged the past of his career, which was giallo, with what was to come, which was he did return to giallo a few times, but also introducing some more supernatural elements. And so with the original Suspiria, yeah, you get a bit of the hallmarks of the giallo, you got the black glove, you got the glinting knife, whatever, but at its heart, it is a fairy tale. It's a dark fairy tale, but fairy tales are dark, and it works. And boy, does it ever work. But with this Suspiria, the director had certain ambitions, shall we say, artistic ambitions. And as I'm watching it, I'm appreciating it. And maybe I'm almost thinking like this is like Deadbringers, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm appreciating it. And it's almost like a tourniquet, this film. It really, like, it's and builds into, like, this orgy of violence. Almost another thing it sort of reminded me of was Mother with Jennifer Lawrence a few years
ago. Oh, yes.
Yeah. And then you feel the cumulative effect on it is, like, you watch and you're like, whoa, I just saw something very, very important. This film is trying to make a statement, maybe too many statements. And then you think to yourself, I don't quite get it, and I'm still trying to piece together. I've Googled many different articles with many different interpretations.
Oh, my God.
Well,
it's funny you use the word important because it would say, oh, is this important with a capital I? Because to quote Family Guy, like there's certain parts where it insists upon itself because it goes the route where instead of making its own magical, self-contained...
realm.
What's the word? Yeah, realm, and it tethers itself to a time and place. I think probably to its detriment, but again, I would be a hypocrite because I want people to be ambitious. I love Luca Guadagnino's ambition to create this backstory and create all multivariate, interesting narratives instead of just Susie figuring out what's going on. There's lots. Susie's almost the third most important character here. So I thought it was wonderfully ambitious, if maybe too ambitious. So, and I felt that this Berlin business was a little bit odd. Like, even as someone who both A, can speak a bit of German, mm-hmm. and B, lived in Germany, I was mystified.
And someone, I mean, I was just in Berlin not even 6 months ago, yeah.
And they're playing to the filmic trope of Berlin being this
This is divided kind of, Berlin, yeah. and the wall was still up.
It's this gray...
The school is in East Germany.
Gray, homogenous, Eastern
Brutalist,
bloc.
Visage. Yeah, I'm using one of your words now. You're teaching me more about architecture, which I
kind of
like.
Yeah, it's like a Bauhaus kind of thing. And yeah, and they're playing that up, but then they're bringing in this Red Army faction, like guerrilla terrorist group thing, which was lost on me.
There's allusions made to, of course, the Second World War and everything, you know, all of the... I guess you want to say atrocities in German history, and I'm trying to connect the dots with what's actually happening within the ballet school, and frankly, I was having difficulty doing so, almost, and again, like, as I think about it now, and I think about myself sitting there, it's wonderful to have allegory in a movie, but it insists upon itself, like you said mm-hmm. before, that it kind of takes you out of the experience, because you're like, okay, like, what are they trying to say? Then it sort of is to the film's detriment. All that allegorical stuff with East-West Germany and the Red Brigade and the terrorism and Patricia, of course, you know, a character from the first movie, in this one played by Chloe Grace Moretz, who happens to be the queen of horror movie remakes.
Oh my gosh, she was in that awful Carrie.
She was also, but she's in a couple of good ones. She was in Let Them In, right? Which was Let the Right One In. And she's kind of decent in this one in a sort of... You sort of made a face. You didn't.
Oh no! I was just thinking. It's going to be interesting as we touch upon maybe Halloween as well, because David Gordon Green was tasked to direct this. Thank God he didn't. But Chloe Grace Moretz, her depiction of mental illness affected me similarly to the Halloween Michael Myers, where he's chained.
I thought it was a bit more affecting.
Well, she's got like wet bangs and she's curled up in a fetal position.
It was very Girl Interrupted.
Yeah, and I thought, well, what if she had just been stone-faced sitting in front of this psychiatrist recounting her tale of atrocities that took place in the school she attended, and then the doctor would have been, oh geez, I don't know what to make. She seems on the face of it rational, but mm-hmm. then she's irrational, and then meanwhile she's practically cowering and crying and curled up in its little ball. It was a little bit
and then
ridiculous.
There's this whole michigas about her now, like, you know, purportedly being a terrorist or being part of a terrorist thing, and that sort of...
Did you say Michigas?
I did say Michigas, yes, I did.
Yeah. It's sort of like a fakakta nonsense there.
No, but the reason why I thought her performance was good was because you would think that an actress of her caliber, because, you know, she's not an A-list actress, but she's a name, would be in the movie more, right? But because we really only see her at the beginning, and the character that she plays in this movie, it's a runaway from the school, just like in the original Suspiria, but it's very, very different. Her arc is very different. And even though we hardly see her again until the very end, I felt like the presence, her presence... At the
I don't mind her being in it, for sure.
No, but I'm saying that her presence loomed over the entire movie, even if she wasn't in it. So I thought she was good. Of course, Tilda Swinton was phenomenal. What about Dakota Johnson?
This is another one that, like, she's terrific. I'm not sure if... It's just, again, you're comparing it to the original, which I purposely did not revisit, but it plays upon your empathy when you have a naif, is that even how you say it? I've only read it.
Yeah.
Umlaut, N-A-I-F. Young girl, the Jennifer Harper in the first one, who's all of probably 16. You really feel her doe-eyed
youthfulness.
Yeah, and her deer in the headlights.
For sure.
And with
Jennifer
this
Harper's
one, she's getting... She's,
Jennifer
she's,
Harper's a treasure. I mean, Phantom of the Paradise and
Suspiria. Another phenomenal one. But it just... Dakota Johnson, she's fantastic. Don't get me wrong. But there seems to be... Like, she seems to have a slightly more of a street savvy that I found took me away from it somehow. Like, she wasn't going in blindly into this thing. Like, and then she's automatically... In a turn of events from the first one, instead of getting dizzy in her audition and in front of everyone, she just nails this performance art dance routine, and just
she's like the
Kobe Bryant interpretive dance.
I was going to say, I mean, just to use a phrase that was so in vogue a few years ago, she's almost like a Mary Sue of ballet. She she's this preternatural, talented, what have you. But it's so, I want to say so much, but I don't want to spoil. That's the problem. She plays Susie Banyan, of course, which is who Jessica Harper played in the original. Her arc, what ends up happening to her, is very different. So how she portrays a character has to be very different because of what ends up happening to the character of Susie Banyan. She can't be so... I
guess that was telegraphed somewhat, somehow, or maybe not. Maybe I'm just reading too much into it. I'm not sure to what extent, but I don't know. Just the dynamic in the school was so different somehow.
Well, let's just talk about the, I guess, 800-pound gorilla, which everyone's talking about, and that is the color palette. If there's one thing that the original Suspiria is known for is its use of primary gel colors. Unbelievable. A feast for the senses in every single way. Visually, the thing is a marvel. Whereas this film, and this was purposely done, is completely devoid of color. And what I don't mean that in the sense like it's black and white. It's just everything seems washed out. Everything seems so
sepia,
muted.
Kind of, yeah.
Not even, just muted. Dull. Drab.
It's almost like The Witch in a way, but again, probably the same production.
You're talking
company.
About Robert Eggers' The Witch? But one thing is that, and this is not original, but this is interesting, is that when you think of the original Suspiria, the one color that comes out that you think of more than anything else,
pink.
I would say red.
Okay.
And this film, it's so muted. It's so, and then you get to the climax, and red is everywhere. So this was a conscious decision by the director to separate itself from the original Suspiria by virtue of the fact that, you know, he's not using that same color palette, which is kind of good because he's acknowledging the fact that, hey, that's what Argento did. He did it masterfully. No need for me to improve upon it. Mm. But then at the end, this thing explodes into an orgy of red. What more can I say? The music. The music in the original Suspiria is a character unto itself. In this one, the score was composed by Tom York of Radiohead. You just shrugged. Yeah. I shrugged too. Radiohead is one of the most, if not the most, overrated bands of my lifetime.
Agreed. That's one of the most humorless, just self-consciously, just pretentious characters in all of music. I mean, he's unbearable. I find Tom York unbearable.
What's hilarious about Radiohead, just to go tangential, I mean, they put out three really good records, and they developed quite a sizable fan base, and when they, after that third record, Kid A, their next one was shite. And
one was that again? I forget.
Like Idiotech or something.
Oh, okay.
And then everything else was just, it was like taking the shite and putting it in the microwave and reheating it. It's the same ambient stupidity, yeah. Right? But their fans have been apologizing for them ever since because of those first three records. They still have a huge fan base. Oh, Radiohead is amazing. Radiohead is this. No, Radiohead sucks. And the music that Tom York put into this film, it never announced itself because it was bad.
Yeah.
You know? It was just, you're more of a music guy than I am. How would you describe it? It was mournful,
just minor
wailing,
key,
minor
lugubrious
key.
Dirging.
Exactly.
That's it. It didn't have that.
You got it, man. Yep.
That is going to be, like, I might play that at my wedding. What the hell?
It's incredible.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, again, these are two things that the original Suspiria are so known for that, for the director to say, okay, we're not going to compete in the music department either. So what are we going to offer? What are we offering viewers in 2018 with this Suspiria that had not been done before? There's a lot of, this film is saying a lot, right? It's trying to talk about something to do with the political allegory of what was happening during the time, combined with a lot of analysis of the female condition. This is a feminist movie. There's nothing wrong with that. At least that's how I read it. So in the other school, there were male dancers,
yes.
There were male characters, etc. This film, there's really only one male character who is of any importance. And then you find out, this is a small spoiler, that character, an elderly German gentleman, was played by Tilda Swinton.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a ruse that was pulled off completely successfully, because I did not see going to this film. I tried to go in as cool as possible, so
yeah,
I knew nothing. And then I'm watching the film, and I'm like, okay, Tilda Swinton is playing
Madame Blanc. And
I don't know who this actor is, this fine elderly actor playing this this psychologist or psychiatrist, but I've never seen him before. Perhaps he's a German actor, but he's good. Then when I found out that was Tilda Swinton, I was blown away. She also played a third role as well.
Yeah, I found that pretty funny for like the ultimate in Pass with Flying Colors Bechdel test movie, that the best character, the one that was the most interesting and the most compelling, was a man, and the fact that it was written and directed by men too. So it's weird, like it's feminist to a certain extent, but Dr. Kemperer was really he was the focal point of the whole thing. So that's an interesting shift that I thought was really effective. Well, take it away from Susie.
I still think the focal point. He was sort of a fringe. He was a fringe character, but he was a character on the fringe of this, almost like a Dr. Loomis, like trying to figure out what's going on and everything.
Yeah. Maybe it's because, I just love Dr. Loomis.
But that is sort of subversive in the fact that the only significant male character is actually played by a woman, when you think about it.
I suppose.
Yeah. Somebody else, I read that, this film is a comment on ballet, because in order to be a successful ballet artist, a female has to contort her body in so many ways it's not meant to. Ergo,
so all the ultimate suffering for your art through this whatever dance macabre kind of thing.
But a lot of that, if it was done in Black Swan, if that is what you're trying to talk about. But so there's
We can talk about that too, because the original Argento movie had no dance whatsoever, and I'm not sure.
Well, there's rehearsals, but dance,
but there wasn't, and I'm not sure to what extent this was effective, because it was I'm not sure, like, is it,
that's our first introduction to the red when we're looking at the outfits of the dancers,
like this weird Japanese bondage get up, and they're just I'm not sure if that sort of style of dance was prevalent in the 70s. Apparently, I guess it was.
These are people on the vanguard of although that dance they put on was called Volk, which means folk, of course. That's supposed to be allegorical too, and it was written by Madame Blanc apparently back in 1947 to reflect the time. So I don't know.
Reflect what?
It was modern dance, something like a thing like Martha Graham would do or something. But I did find that scene to be extremely hypnotic. I found the choreography to be wonderful. I was photographed incredibly. It looked phenomenal, and then the plot just propels to its pretty mind-numbing conclusion. And when I say mind-numbing, I mean in the sense that the audience is being barraged with so much information, so much visual stimuli, that you're watching it and the cumulative effect is, this is something very, very significant. And then the movie ends, the credits roll, and you're kind of sitting there going, and again, I'm repeating what I said in Dead Ringers, you're like, wow, that was something pretty fucking deep and cool. And then you try to say yourself, well, see, because I saw it by myself. So I said to myself, self, what does it mean? And I had a few little hypotheses here and there, but the dots never connected. And so I was hoping that we could connect the dots together, but I feel if we're going to do that, we're probably going to spoil the film more than we should. So this is probably one of the most obtuse discussions we've ever had about a film.
Well, I didn't connect the... I am brain fart here. The first character's demise in the first
Patricia.
I didn't connect the whole Red Army faction thing. Like this was a part of history that was lost on me, and I thought maybe if they had done something with the Munich terror attack, it would have been something more people could relate to. Maybe it would be imbued with much more significance if we were European. But I found a sort of a distance from that. I didn't connect anything to do with this character, I won't say their later affiliation with this terror group. It was lost on me. I didn't understand, maybe she went nutso because of being embroiled in this clandestine coven thing. They were trying to draw lines that I didn't see were direct lines, and that was a little bit weak, but the other bit with Dr. Klemperer's love interest was very touching.
That was
very
touching.
If not somewhat predictable, because they did give different historical, I guess, touchstones. Like, he was a Jungian, you could see that coming in a way, but it didn't make it any less impactful. It was really quite beautiful. Mm-hmm. And the movie...
And, again, I don't want to spoil it, but when we see his love interest, that gave me absolute goosebumps.
Yeah, that was incredible.
That moment alone was worth the price of admission.
Dr. Klemper, he's off at his cottage with his dacha, I believe it's called. It's like this Eastern Bloc sort of shanty hut, and he goes to retreat there to collect his thoughts.
They kept
calling
it his country home.
Yeah, like, and I was like, where's the country
home? Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, there's not some sprawling acreage, and but it was just, it seemed very like
Spartan.
The most
desolate, barren, industrial-looking area. But
anyway. That was really great. Like, I thought everything revolved around Madame Blanc and Klemper, and whenever they were on screen, I was just so riveted, and whenever they weren't, it was just not as much so, but that was really compelling, and it was really very touching, I think the New Yorker was really unkind. They said it was really shoehorned in, and they complained about it. I thought it was kind of neat, although I thought they would have been better served to focus on one subplot and one facet of Berlin's history instead of delving into all of Germany's post-war guilt all at once.
The other thing too is because they were dealing with, like, they were juggling so many subplots. In fact, one of the articles I read that attempted to make Hezard Hills this movie said this is a film that has doors within doors, behind doors, and other doors. And that to me was just the writer's way of saying, I don't get it either. You know?
Sure. Well, you can read so much into this. You can say, okay, Olga, the woman who's, she had a seizure, she's bubbling at the mouth, and exercising the demons of red communist Russia, because Berlin was treated by Hitler as being this red outpost.
The more we talk about this, the more I'm starting to think that this whole shoehorning now, and I'm not talking about the subplot with Kempler, and his love interest, the shoehorning in of all this political shit that's going on at the time and the political history of like East and West Germany is a debit. It's taking us out of the film because we're trying to decipher what the heck was he trying to do with this stuff? What is he trying to say? And meanwhile, this is a film about a coven of witches. And I think in many ways it might have detracted from the actual story of the witches, because frankly, I don't even know what the witches' endgame is in this Suspiria. I knew what it was in the original Suspiria, but what is it in this one?
Yeah, and if it's supposed to be some metaphor or analog for what? Like some secret society where they stab one in another in the back or in the neck, as the case may be.
Well, it was almost like, and this is coming right now. I mean, this honestly is nothing that I thought of earlier, but like, we're talking about Germany, right? And we're talking about, let's say, World War II. And we're talking about the Holocaust. And we're talking about Adolf Hitler wanting to create a nation of the Übermensch, right?
Mm.
The perfect Aryan, of which he looked nothing like.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? 6 foot tall, blonde, blue-eyed. In other words, he also wanted to create, the Übermensch, I mean, the Uber female, so to speak, would have been the same, Aryan, blonde, etc. Now, looking at this movie, it seemed to me that with the Coven of Witches, it was very much about deconstruction and reconstruction, and it's almost like the end game was to create the perfect matriarchy, almost in the sense of how Adolf Hitler wanted to create the perfect populace of Germany.
Hmm.
That here they are trying, because what they're doing is they're, again, spoiler alert, they're cherry picking who is going to continue on in this coven, right?
Yeah, picking the best phenotype and genotype, mm-hmm. I guess, who would be, yeah.
And then
Susie, and
you infer that the end game is to take over the world, or at least to make their, if not overtly, implicitly. So yeah, they're creating the perfect matriarchy of witches.
Who knows? I have no idea. I didn't know what to make of this internecine debates they had, where they had, there's a quite a affecting but weird vote where they're trying to pick the next one, and they're going through their kitchen and they have this dinner, an elaborate dinner, and they're yelling out who they feel, I guess, should head the coven. Is that what it was? And they're shouting like, Marcos,
yeah.
Marcos.
Mm-hmm.
And they're having like this weird plebiscite for the coven, and it's like, what? What's, I don't understand. To what end, right?
That's the whole thing.
Because they're trying to presumably, like vampires, replenish their stock,
mm-hmm.
by attaching their energy to this new recruit who was preordained.
Exactly.
I have no idea.
There is preordained, but then at the same time, there's also a non-natural selection, but unnatural selection, because then what they're doing is they're separating the wheat from the chaff, and they're creating the perfect, like as I said before, matriarchy of witches. And that whole analogy that I just made with Adolf Hitler, I just pulled it out of my ass.
That's funny you say that, because in the original Suspiria, they didn't hammer you over the head with Reich. They actually, there's the scene of Daniel, the blind man, with his German Shepherd, which obviously German Shepherd has all these connotations of the army dog. And he's wandering around Königsplatz in Munich, which is famous for Munich, where the beer hall putsch and where Hitler gave this rousing speech. So you have this stark neoclassical architecture where you have this barren, like, square of really imposing buildings, almost like... probably the Beijing right now, like in you know, or in Red Square or something, where this huge imposing totalitarian structure, and then you have this blind guy walking through there, which is a really neat conceit, where it's like a blind guy walking through history blindly, not seeing what's coming up, and that's an allusion to Nazism, but not
by his
he's attacked
German
by
Shepherd.
Yes, and that was a really effective scene, and not something where it's so text versus subtext. It was really, and that wasn't even. That was just one a little tiny nod to Germany's past. I feel like every movie is set in Germany, in a way, has to address the World War II guilt.
Like, I feel bad for Germany, honestly, because of that. Because I love Germany. Germany is, I would say, my third home. My second home is New York City. Every time I go there, I feel like I'm at home. And frankly, I've never said this to you before, I'm actually mulling... a permanent move to Berlin.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's not going to happen this year.
No.
Probably not next year. So don't worry. There'll still be episodes of the podcast.
But interesting.
Yeah, when I was only there for 5 days, and for the second I left my hotel, I was like, this is where I belong.
It's just so funny. That just that city just carries with it so much baggage. In a way
that's
almost
thing,
like
that's
if
mean,
you have a romantic
that, like,
comedy, you set it in Paris because Paris is romance.
Yeah.
Paris is the city of lights. It's always someone who trips over an ottoman and then they sing. And
meanwhile,
they
Paris
meet.
Is one of the most overrated cities in Europe. But no, I mean, that's what I was trying to say earlier about how I feel bad for Germany, because Germany is multicultural. Berlin and Frankfurt and whatever. Yes, there are still problems, etc. That's happened throughout Europe. But the reality is Germany has atoned beyond belief. Anytime, for example, 9/11, the first, I guess, I don't know.
Overtures,
exactly, was from Germany.
Yeah, exactly.
We stand with you, America. Germany...
Yeah, that was really positive.
Exactly. Yeah. Germany is... But because of the atrocities that happened in the past, Germany will... I don't think will ever shake off those shackles. So, yeah, they have to keep being subjected to these movies that keep reminding them of a past that they don't necessarily want to forget, but at the same time, they don't want to keep acknowledging over and over and over again. One thing that's amazing about Germany is when you go there... You see monuments. This is where a synagogue once stood. This is where, you know, the students burn all the subversive books, etc. So they're paying homage to the past by putting monuments there, honoring it, and trying to move forward. But cinema won't let them move forward.
But it shouldn't be that big a deal to try and reference two historical incidents, one with which none of us is familiar, which is the hijacking of this Lufthansa jet and subsequent murder of the pilot, and also this the heavy baggage of the Third Reich. But given that it's a divided city, maybe they should have just focused on east and west and the divide there and the falling of the wall and how the two different sides of Berlin had to coexist. And that would have been a maybe more interesting issue to explore. You don't have to ground it in 1977 just because Argento shot there. Like, it seems irrelevant in a
but,
way.
You know, I find it kind of telling that we are now almost 40 minutes into this podcast and we're talking about Germany and politics and allegory, and we're not talking about the horror. We're not talking about the witches. And this is a horror film. And so I think the shoehorning of all that sort of stuff, as who was it, the New York Times has said?
Oh, the New Yorker said they shoehorned in the Holocaust bit and it had no real resonance. It seemed very tacked on.
But what what that might have done is detracted from some very effective horror, because there are some scenes in this film that are extremely effective.
Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live, Exodus. And I'm quoting the Bible here about witches. So, like, the witch part, that was... I mean, I thought that was really great how they were conspiring, and you could see them in the it was almost like West Wing style politicking, politicking? Politicking. And how they're all, yeah, again.
I think it's pronounced politoking. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, okay, now. And I love the background machinations, and I love I don't want to spoil it, but the one character's demise. I loved how the Madame Blanc was almost like a... she was almost like a kingmaker in a certain respect. Like, she had a real power to determine where the coven was heading, and she had certain reservations about, and I'm being intentionally oblique about this, but I loved her character, that she wasn't like, I don't know, that she maintained like a distance, and she was not willing to go along with the group to a certain extent. And let's just leave it that way. But I thought it was interesting how much of the witches were involved, and the ambition to take Susie Banyan in a completely different direction. Really amazing, even if I didn't find... I thought that was a little bit telegraphed too much, but you can't fault... a film for having too much ambition. I was going to make a sports analogy earlier. The Halloween reboot is in baseball, like a bunt to advance the runner, and this is a swing for the fences. So what would you rather do? Go for broke and do something completely new, or just do something safe and statistically sound, which is advancing the runner with a bunt? So that was what... Well, Halloween was all things to all people, and this is incredibly polarizing.
It's often, I mean, if you're going to take that sports analogy further, I mean, it's often strategic, whether you're going to bunt, let's say you've got bases loaded, right? Just get that last runner in, or go for a grand slam, a home run. So when you take that swing, you're either going to miss or you're going to connect and hopefully hit the home run. So is this a swing or a miss, or is this a swing and up?
Well, I just want to give us some credit, because we always like ambition. And even if it falls flat in some respects, I like the fact that it was a different beast, which is why I stopped rewatching Suspiria, because I didn't want to compare and contrast. Because different color palette, different narrative, different structure, set in a somewhere rather than an elsewhere. It had so much, there was so much different that it almost wills you to not discuss the original in a way that Halloween did the exact opposite.
Well, and that's the whole thing, too. And I have to be very, very... I have to talk around it, but... Callbacks, right? Halloween.
Many.
And it was like you're bludgeoned over the head. It was almost like bombardment in The Simpsons. I mean, that ball was coming at you again and again and again and again. This one did it in a way that was elegant. Yeah. So I'm going to give it credit for that. I think it was a very valiant swing. It wasn't a home run, maybe a double. I don't know. See, and you say you give us credit. Yes, I mean, we do tolerate ambiguity. We do tolerate a film that isn't wrapped up with a nice bow at the end. And we like to discuss these things. The only thing that I feel that we sort of are doing a disservice is that we have not come to any sort of conclusive agreement as to what this film is ultimately trying to say. Now, I think a lot of that's part and parcel of the fact that we're being very conscious of not spoiling things. I almost think, first of all, this is a film, just by the virtue of its ambition, begs for a rewatch. And I will be rewatching. I'll probably end up buying this film and rewatching it a number of times. I think I'd like to revisit it, say, a year from now when everyone has seen it and we don't have to worry about spoiling. There's a lot of things that we can talk about. But for the time being, I think we should maybe... Askew? What did we learn? Yeah. I mean, this whole podcast is basically, what did we learn? Which is, we don't quite get it, but we appreciate it. So, star rating, Chris.
Ooh, because I have a lot more that I've learned. But
okay, go ahead. Don't let me stop you.
I'm going to give it a 3.25. The debits I've described earlier, I liked the original self-contained world. And I was thinking about like the character Kay in Kafka's The Castle. And he's this contractor, although it wouldn't be... that he's a carpenter, but today you'd call him a contractor who's...
So you're saying if Jesus walked the earth today, he'd be a contractor?
He'd be a contractor, yeah.
And how to catch a contractor. Jesus Christ, imagine that.
The parallels between the first scene where Susie Banyan is being driven to the school and Kafka's The Castle are pretty close, because he's summoned to the castle to do a job. And every time he... hails a a coach, then there's something that interrupts his journey to get there that makes, and it's a dreamlike state where either he falls asleep or the coach driver gets lost. There's a circularity to it. He doesn't know where he's going. Susie Banyan is in this cab, and there's this bizarre scene where the cab driver is talking to her, and her German is limited. She tries to ask for an address, and they don't understand. And there's this rain, and it's this nightmarish dreamscape, and you don't know what's going on. It doesn't. It's not real. Like, he's driving, but it's not realism that you could see. He's on the Autobahn or something. He's sort of driving around, and you don't know. You're not convinced this is real. Mm. And the self-contained hermetical world that Argento creates is so incredible. And the skylight scene of the girl's demise is something that will just blow your mind. And we'd be remiss if we didn't mention
the whole film,
the demise in this film, which is a body horror death, mm-hmm. which is something that I think David Cronenberg would appreciate. I didn't understand it. I didn't see the connection. It was twisted, no pun intended. It was really something that that's going to stick with me for the rest of my days, and in a way that nothing in Halloween did.
I would say the last 20 minutes of this film. This is a lengthy movie, 2.5 hours. The last 20 minutes have stuck with me.
Yeah, it was a subterranean terror, the likes of which we hadn't seen since Baskin.
I was going to say, they had a Baskin vibe.
That was really phenomenal. So the takeaway message is that there's lots of pluses in the ledger sheet and considerable minuses, but the former outweigh the latter.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing. I mean, when I heard that they were going to remake Suspiria, I was prepared to hate it in every aspect of the film, and the fact that I'm giving this one 3 stars is shows you that I actually respect what the filmmakers were trying to achieve. I respect the fact that they took Suspiria, used some familiar brushstrokes, went in a completely different direction. I respect the fact that there was a lot of ambition, but as you two said, ambition sometimes bites nails of success. It's no secret.
Wow, what a quote.
That song, I think, came on my Spotify play today on shuffle. So, yes, the ambition sort of bit the nails of this success. And therefore, I'm giving it 3 stars, which is a decline of what I was going to give it upon walking out. I actually texted you, said, it's really, really good. I was all set to give it 4 stars. And then I started thinking about it, analyzing it, trying to connect the dots, and I thought to myself, you know what? This could very well be a case of the Emperor not really wearing any clothes. So
it's so tough because the people who are most vociferous in their opposition are saying it's pretentious, which is like, it's an incredibly nebulous word to define. Like, I'm not sure how to define that.
Pretense and horror is, I mean, people, it makes me think that if The Shining came out today, if Rosemary's Baby came out today, even if The Exorcist might have come out today, people would have called it pretentious. It seems like anything that's not a slasher is defined as pretentious. Things that are cerebral, like, let's say, Hereditary or The Witch or what have you,
slings and arrows slung at those films for being pretentious? I'm not sure to the same extent. Like, The Witch, definitely not the case. Although it had these more broad brushstroke themes, but there's something about this one that word is coming to the fore, and I have no idea
why.
The original was an art film.
Yeah, no, it's because of the political allegory, and it's because of the fact that I think most people are picking up on the fact that they're trying to make connections, but the connections just aren't there. And so sometimes when people are unable to tie things up in a neat ribbon, they dismiss it. Summarily by saying it's pretentious. So yeah, that's why I think people are calling it pretentious. And frankly, the more when I watch it again, I may start to realize that there really is no connection whatsoever. And
well, we'll see, because we're tilting the balance here, because I gave the most tepid 3-star review to Halloween, and I said I have to see it again, but not for the reasons you cited. I said probably
I don't think I'm ever going to see the new Halloween ever again.
I'm inclined to agree, and I think my rationale for saying that was probably to convince myself I wasn't already inherently correct in my suspicions that this thing was a piece of shite. Mm-hmm. So, but I'm not sure. I think I have to work myself through the. I think I have some like Damien Hirst type vibe surrounding, like art with a capital A surrounding this movie, where that artist hung a shark in formaldehyde, and you're supposed to say that's brilliant because why? It's a shark hanging in formaldehyde. Like, I don't
get... That's not the pissed Jesus artist, is it?
No. I forget his name, but Damien Hirst. Yeah, it's like, I'll take a shark, like suspend it, and I don't understand. And I'm supposed to feel bad for not understanding. Like, I don't understand his conception of this stupid shark, really, because it is a stupid shark, and there's no subtext. He's a shitty artist. So I get some of these vibes here, and I'm going to cite a passage where Madame Blanc says, "Dance cannot be beautiful or cheerful." And I thought that was like Sprockets, like Michael Myers. It was like a corn, like... There's no art form that cannot not be beautiful. It's beautiful, inherently beautiful, dance. So even
when art is at its most sublime, and when I say sublime, I mean the truest definition of sublime, in the sense that it actually fills you with some sort of beautiful revulsion, right? It's beautiful.
Hmm.
Art is always beautiful, even if it's confrontational, even if it's ugly, even if it's meant to make you sort of contemplate some of your deepest, darkest phobias, anxieties, what have you. Art, by its very nature, is beautiful. The problem is that art, the beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
Well, it could so just mean person, like our lack of affinity for interpretive dance. Like maybe
what
she's
saying is that they weren't putting on Swan Lake, and that's the end of that.
Right, fine. Fair enough. I didn't know what to make of that. Three and a quarter for me, because there's no way I'm not going to not see this again, because I have to, it's obviously, I said earlier before we hit record that every criticism and every lauding of this film is almost correct. Like, it's almost impossible to cherry pick which one you're going to take, because everything I've read that said it's overlong and somewhat pretentious, I agree with. Also, they've said that it's incredibly beautiful and gut punch, audacious body horror. This is also true. So I don't know to what extent either is true. And that's probably why, like, we have this artificial 5-star review system here. We can go right down the middle and give like a B-3 star, but I'm really not sure. Like, I'm left somewhat befuddled but not full of regret. I'm full of anticipation and full of
ebullition. Revisit this again.
To revisit it.
Mm-hmm.
And kudos to them, because this was met with a lot of trepidation and not most notably
skepticism,
by us, and skepticism. And kudos for Luca Guadagnino, who compares his own cinema to an arrow fired through time, which I thought was really neat. And I don't understand. But but maybe to his credit, I thought, okay, does that mean the trajectory will inevitably land to the point where no one cares about this arrow? Or does it mean that... I don't know. But I thought, for a guy, he said he had a vision of, since he was 12, to redo this movie. He loves the source material.
In Magnolia? I love it's one of my favorite films, where somebody's chastising somebody for, you know, and he says, "You speak in riddles and enigmas and rub-a-dub-dub," or something like that. That sort of sounds like that to me, you know.
Very well be. Yeah. Like, the jury's still out, but I'm inclined to be biased enough that I would be selected out of this court proceedings, because I like it.
Well, and I like it too. However, if we're going to continue that analogy, I'm not convinced. I'm going to say not guilty right now. The jury is still hung.
Yeah.
We are there. We are sort of leaning more towards that not guilty verdict, or guilty depending on the context of the case. But we're not quite there just yet. So, having said that, we need to see this film again. And do we recommend it? Wholeheartedly.
You have to see it for yourself and share your suggestions with us to see where we've gone
off the rails. Your interpretations, what have you.
Yeah.
Yep.
Really awful movies at gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter, awful_movies, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.